regard as a curse. See, he may fiend and have a dream because he's seen a team.
Welcome, everybody, to the Let's Talk About Sex session. I'm Dean Dadson, and I'm going to be facilitating the session today. The session really is sort of a panel and an audience discussion about sexuality, about relationships, and about rights. And it's also about the issues that people face, people with a disability face, when it comes to realising relationships, sexuality, and their rights. And it's also about where do people with a disability go to get some information about their rights, and what to do if people aren't getting their rights. So the way it's sort of going to work is we've got an expert panel here, and I'll introduce them in a moment. But I'd also like to say that we'd love audience participation. So if people have comments and questions throughout, please don't hesitate. We've got two people here with roving microphones. So if you have questions or comments that you want to put to the panel, please do that throughout. And we'll also have time at the end for questions. So I'm going to introduce some of the panel members, and then it's going to be followed by a short film, which will be captioned on this side, because unfortunately it doesn't even have any captions or subtitles on it, and the video will show on that side. So let me start off with Christian Asturian here on my left. Christian's the program manager of Disability and Diversity at the Migrant Resource Centre Northwest. Christian's fluent in Italian, French, Greek and English, which he has put to practical use in the management of the Disability and Diversity program. He's developed a deep understanding of cross-cultural awareness. Christian also runs his own business as a disability consultant, and his specialist skills means that his knowledge is often required on a variety of committees. He's currently on the advisory committee for the Victorian Human Rights Commission, the Victorian Government Disability Services Commissioner Board, and the Federation of Ethnic Community Councils of Australia Disability Committee. Next to Christian is Dr. George Talaporis, and I'm just going to find a little bio here for George. George is manager of the Youth Disability Advocacy Service. George completed his PhD in psychology, investigating disability and relationships, and has expertise in disability reform and youth engagement. He's held managerial roles in advocacy and played a leadership role in the development of individualised and self-directed support. George has provided policy advice in a range of areas, including DHS standards, capacity building through peer support, individualised support packages, and the implementation of the NDIS in Victoria. He's currently the manager of the Youth Disability Advocacy Service, a lecturer in disability and health at Deakin University, and a regular contributor to the ABC disability portal Ramp Up, which is sadly gone. So welcome, George. Next to George is Dr. Patsy Frawley, a research fellow at La Trobe University. Patsy's been working alongside people with an intellectual disability for over 25 years as an educator, an advocate, a policy advisor and a researcher. Her research focus is on sexuality and relationships, abuse prevention, rights and self-advocacy. Through this work, she's developed inclusive and collaborative approaches to researching with people with an intellectual disability. Patsy's worked on some innovative programs, including the Living Safer Sexual Lives, Respectful Relationships Peer Education Program. And that was a program that's been run across Australia and used to inform violence prevention programs for women with disabilities internationally. Beside Patsy is Glyn Evans. So Glyn is the team leader from the Assist outreach program at Gippsland Department of Human Services. So Glenn's passionate about ensuring that people with a disability are given the same opportunities and experiences in life as everyone else in the community. Glenn works at the Department of Human Services in Gippsland with the Assist Outreach Program, and that program provides skills development education with people with a disability. And finally, we have Sharon Granick, Program Manager at Women with Disabilities Victoria. Sharon's worked for many years in community development in the field of diversity, including case management, residential and respite care, policy development, housing, education, training and employment, public health and advocacy. Sharon has a Master's in Human Services and Public Policy, and Sharon helped to establish and was the first coordinator of the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. More recently, she was a member of the project management team that oversaw the Voices Against Violence research project. A cross-sector partnership with the Office of the Public Advocate and the Domestic Violence Resource Centre Victoria. And this investigated what happens to women with disabilities who have experienced violence in Victoria. And we have an apology from Greg Axtons. He wasn't able to make it today, but Greg Axtons is a long-serving or a long-time activist and self-advocate. And his passion was around the issues, or is around the issues, of sexuality and people with a disability. So apologies from Greg today. So I'd like to start off really thanking everybody for coming, the panel, and thank you, members of the audience. And if we can go to this film, and we'll have a bit of a discussion about that afterwards. It goes for about 8 minutes. Thank you.
Actually, you'd never really succeed in doing very much with my life, and that was all the way through my childhood.
Richard Blake was diagnosed with a learning disability at an early age. But it was in his teenage years that he first realised he had gay feelings.
Unfortunately, in special schools, you never had any sexual relationship training or any sex education. It just didn't happen. So in the time when I was going through it, it's a bit like, actually, what are these feelings? What is happening to me? Why do I fancy this person? And you don't understand the reasons why, because you start thinking, is it just a learning difficulty, or do I have something else for me as well?
Richard might not have known it then, but his experience wasn't unique. In 2005, academics at Bristol University's Nora Fry Research Centre published groundbreaking research into the loves and lives of those who are lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender with learning difficulties.
I think LGBT people with learning disabilities have all of the same kinds of experiences that anybody who's gay faces growing up, disabled or not disabled, feeling like you're the only person in the world, feeling that you're very different, feeling that you can't share that. I think what becomes different as they grow older is that it becomes very difficult to express your sexuality if you have a learning disability, because society in general expects you to be asexual or to not be interested in sex.
Richard still hadn't come out when he went into residential care at age 19, but when he started living independently, his feelings about telling his care workers changed.
I wanted to have a relationship, and when you live independently, you have what they call person-centred reviews, and you have like a monthly review or a yearly review, and for about 3 years, all they wanted to talk about was, how am I doing with spending? What my life with doing my own laundry, cooking and washing. And actually, all very important things to talk about, but I wanted to talk about having a relationship. And for every single time it was brought up, it always seems to be, well, we can talk about that a bit later on, but we never actually got to a point of talking about it. It always sort of like got swept under the carpet. What I decided to do was to have a review who are people I wanted to invite, so I could say to them, look, this is who I am, and this is the support I need.
Richard's revelation got a reaction which shocked him.
The first response was, oh, it's just a phase we're going through. We're not going to do anything at the moment because we think you'll get over it, and actually in a couple of months' time you may be thinking differently. Being able to give the confidence, be able to actually be able to say this, and then being told it's a phase, it's sort of like one minute you're on a high because actually you come out and you actually tell somebody, and the next minute like you're almost on the floor thinking, oh my God, why did I do that? Why have I just said that? Have I just made the biggest mistake by actually telling somebody this? It made me feel like it was wrong. It made me feel actually the support I needed and wanted, yeah, I may not get any more.
People that we spoke to in our study, when they reflected on their experiences of bullying, discrimination and homophobia, I suppose what was most alarming or distressing was that it very often came from very close family members, but also from staff in services, where people often got a very clear message that it wasn't okay to be gay.
Now aged 26 and fed up with his sexuality not being taken seriously, Richard finally decided to speak out.
I got the confidence to be able to say to somebody, look, this is who I am. You're being paid to give me the care I need, yeah? And this is part of my care I need. I need some support to be the person who I am.
Eventually, Richard decided to make a formal complaint.
My support became the best support you could imagine. So I think if I hadn't done that, I hadn't put that complaint in, then the support would never have actually really changed very much.
There's quite clear policy about how people with learning disabilities should be supported in different aspects of their life. There's been two major white papers, and they're quite clear that sexuality and relationships are a topic in which people must proactively be given support. And we found very little evidence of proactive work of services thinking, what are we going to do to try and help support people?
Richard had still not come out publicly by age 30. Then, during a trip to London, he chanced upon the gay scene.
It was slightly scary because actually I didn't know this area even existed. And for me it was like, do I turn around and go back into my hotel room and not come out anymore this evening? Or do I actually go somewhere and actually go for a drink? I just went and found a little corner, went and sat in a corner, had a glass of wine, and that was it. I didn't really speak to anybody. And actually, it's not as bad as what people say it is, because social workers and support workers will always look at the risk. They will never look at the enjoyment, first of all. So if you say to a support worker, I'm going to go into London and I'm going to hit a couple of gay nightclubs or a couple of gay pubs, the first thing they're going to start thinking of, are you safe? What's going to happen? God, all of these things could happen to you. And obviously support workers have a duty to say these things to you. Actually, this might happen to you. But I do think sometimes they make it more scarier so people don't try things.
I think that what people need is, and what people said they wanted, was their support worker to actually go with them, certainly in the first instance, to a gay venue and just help them understand a bit more about what's going on here, how does it work, what should I do, how should I be, and to have some support in those first instances.
I think it's about wrapping people up in cotton wool, and I think it's about releasing some of that, wrapping up, releasing that person to actually make mistakes, because it's life. You don't go through life without making mistakes.
I think the important assumption to challenge is that somehow there are classes of people who are entitled or capable or competent enough to access inner emotions around sex, sexuality and love, and there are others who are not. And I mean, that's the challenge to services to think about and to find individual solutions and individual ways of supporting people to express their needs.
Richard is now proud to be out. He's co-chair of the National Forum for People with Learning Disabilities and leads sexuality training for care workers.
So
I was always told, actually,
he's still going. So whilst that film really is about a gay man's desire to come out, to be supported, to have a relationship, to have a sexual relationship, I'd like to ask the panel members if there was a particular issue in that film that resonated or that was particularly important to each of you. So we might start off. Patsy, would you like to start?
Okay,
thank you.
Sure. Okay, that's what you get for looking at the facilitator. there was a few points that I think, that I wrote notes about, and of course when I first watched Richard's story, it actually reminded me very much of the stories that I've heard and worked with for many years now with people with an intellectual disability through the Living Safer Sexual Lives work. So as Dean said, whilst Richard's a key thing for Richard was about being gay and coming out, he also raised a lot of things that are about being a person with an intellectual disability and having sexuality and relationships recognised in your life. The three things for me was that he raised the issue that he'd never been provided with any education while he was at school or any other time in his life, that to get sexuality and his sexuality and relationships actually recognised and brought out in the open so that he could get support was wholly dependent on him, and he said he had to have the confidence to do that, and it made me think how hard that would be for people, and I know that it is for the people that I've worked with, to actually, in a formal meeting, like a formal planning meeting, to say, oh, by the way, can we talk about sex? I would find that very difficult because sex and relationships are often very, very private things in our lives, and we don't sit around a table at a formal meeting and start writing things down about what we want to do and how we want to do it. So that was another important thing. And finally was his reflection, I think, that unfortunately, very often, the only time that anyone wants to talk to him about sex and relationships or all they want to talk about is managing risk. And here was a man who was wanting to talk about desire, about his particular, you know, interests in sexual relationships, going to a club. He wanted to talk about real experiences, not about managing risk. So they're some of the things that really came out for me that I think are very much the themes that I've heard for the 20-odd years that I've been doing work in this area. So finally, I guess the question is, how far have we come?
Thank you, Patsy. I might go over to Dr. George Telepouris for your comments.
Sure. Can that get closer? I think that the disconnect between policy and practice is also very clear. I know that in Victoria back in 2005, there was a lot of work that went into a document. It had lovely cartoons on the cover. Remember, Patsy, the DHS, lovely drawings of people out in the streets and enjoying the sunshine, and the policy was the DHS policy on sexuality. And the policy said lots of really positive things. It said that people with disabilities have a right to express their sexuality, have a right to support to do this. But what was really obvious was there was no information about how. And, you know, we're almost 10 years on, and I think that we're in the same space today, that people have the right intentions, and the policy sort of says all the right things, but when it comes to practical, on-the-ground, real support for people, that it's not really there.
Okay, thank you, George. Sharon, could we get a comment from you, please?
I guess I'll talk about a different area, because I totally agree with what George and Patsy have said already. One... phrase that was used really got to me was, you'll get over it as a phase you're going through. And to me, that rings parallels with women with disabilities who may have a cognitive disability are never allowed to grow up. So they're not allowed to get out of that phase, but you'll get over the phase of having homosexual feelings. So that really resonated for me. The other area that's of concern to me is that we're looking at sexual health rather than a health relationship, and that's what something brought out in the short video we saw, was that he was looking for a healthy relationship, and that's wonderful. And we've got to think about skilling up workers to assist him to find those health, or assist people with disabilities to find those healthy relationships, because a lot of people with disabilities don't have the full expansion of life experiences that the general community experience. It's up to us to make sure those experiences can be expanded. That's really important.
And so isn't it also the unhealthy relationships too, that we, you know, every person growing up experiences all kinds of relationships. They're not always the healthiest of sorts.
That's cool. The dignity of risk.
Yeah,
right.
That dignity of risk issue was quite clear, that he did not... there was about being wrapped up in a cotton wool or not.
Exactly, you're right there. I think you need to experience. How do you know what kind of relationship you want without treading the water, getting into the water, getting your feet wet? If you're only ever exposed to a heterosexual relationship on TV or whatever, how do you know that you might, what's your preference if you have those limited life experiences? So I think you're right on there that. Sometimes it's okay as long as you're supported through an unhealthy relationship. As long as the support is there, I think.
Okay. Christian, do you have some comments?
There are good things really that talk with me about this video. One is the denial of a basic human right, which is about having the opportunity to experience relationship and to experience sex in any form, really. And the other thing that makes me think, when the guy was talking about being covered in cotton wool, because this is something that very often we see about people with a disability being over-protected for so many different reasons. And as a consequence of that, there is the denial of the experience. Like everybody in life, really. And also the idea of thinking that people with a disability are not sexual beings, are not interested in.
Okay, thank you, Christian.
Or that we're oversex, so there's that, you're either not interested or you just can't stop, so you need to be controlled. That's me, but anyway.
Go for it.
But also, I think it was David Thompson was the academic who was talking there from Bristol, and one of the things that he said was that there also seems to be a sense that there's haves and have-nots in terms of sex and relationships. And as Christian said, being sexual is one of the most human of expressions. And it's incredibly, it goes against everything we could ever think about to cut off that from certain people just because they have a disability. And I know that for many people with an intellectual disability, with whom I've spent most of the time talking about sex and relationships, They might know other people in their families, for example, where they're supported to, you know, grow up and have relationships and in fact encouraged to have the dream, whereas as a person with an intellectual disability, they're told in no uncertain terms, that's not for you. And of course, we then have a whole range of things that happen to people. For example, the sterilisation of women with intellectual disabilities, that still occurs, that absolutely says, that's not for you. And I think that, you know, the question is not about necessarily how do we support people to learn more so that they can be sexual. I think it's more about how do we fully acknowledge the sexuality of people with disabilities through what we talk about, what we advocate for, and how we try and shape policy and practice.
Thanks, Patsy. I might pass over to Glyn Evans. I think one of the issues that you've all raised is around cotton wooling, about the dignity of risk, of being people being able to take risks. And I don't want to put Glyn on the spot, but Glyn works for DHS. So Glyn's our service provider representative. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe talk about that dignity of risk, but also if you could talk about what resonated from that film for you.
Sure. On a positive note, that's a good way to start.
Yeah.
We actually run advocacy meetings within our service at DHS, Assist Outreach. And at one of the advocacy meetings, we have quite a few people from community residential units attend. We were actually showing the AMIDA Know Your Rights video, and relationships is one of the rights that people have. So we were talking about the right to have a relationship, and quite a few people in the CRU said, yes, you know, they can have a relationship. We spoke about boyfriend and girlfriend, and yep, they can have a boyfriend and girlfriend, and I'm thinking, wow, this is great. So, you know, your boyfriend can come and sleep with you in your bed, you know, that's okay. Everything went quiet, and obviously, you know, that was pretty horrific thing to say. So it was pretty obvious in speaking further that most people in a CRU think that a boyfriend is somebody that, you know, we call a boyfriend and a girlfriend's a girlfriend, and that may well be nice, but unfortunately no sex and no physical touching and no privacy from what we could gather. Also from that meeting, people expressed a need to have their own human relations, women's and men's groups develop. So we actually run them now, and we've been running them for 8-9 years. And within those groups, people talk about sex. They actually talk about condoms, and they talk about penises, and they talk about vaginas. And there's a group of them here now. And I know that every single one of them knows how to put a condom on a penis, because we practice that. We actually watched that video last Tuesday, I think. Was it last Tuesday, guys? Yes. And we spoke about lesbian relationships, and we spoke about gay relationships. And where do you go if you would actually like to become involved in a lesbian relationship? That's right, Liz, you had some answers. So did some of the others within the group. So we are becoming more aware, and we are speaking out, and people are developing confidence, but we've got a long, long way to go.
Dean, do you mind if I just add to that?
Go for it.
I think that's great that you're doing that, and that relationships are being spoken about. One thing that I think is sometimes missing is that sex is presented to people with disabilities as something that can only occur within the relationship. And the reality is that for a lot of people, you know, disabled or not, sex occurs in all sorts of strange places, including disabled toilets. So we need to, you know, recognise that it's not just about that, you know, that normative idea of relationships where sex occurs. And, you know, sex can also be something that you do on your own in terms of masturbation and that sort of thing, and and porn and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
So
we need to be
as broad as we possibly can when we talk about sex.
For sure. Can I just add that I subscribe to Red, the sex workers magazine, which is sent to DHS, I might add. We use that magazine quite extensively and have spoken to most of the providers, and they've given us pretty much an overview of what they have to offer. One of the members here today is actually supporting another person to access a sex worker. Not too sure if he hasn't already done that, but we won't put him in the spotlight. But it's been organised. So, you know, we're very open, and we do talk about a lot of inappropriate sexual activities as well. We're obviously involved with Patsy and the Living Safer Sexual Lives program extensively, and with Sharon and the project that Sharon's just been involved in.
Can the sex worker come to the CIU?
Sorry, can a sex worker come to a CIU?
Well, look, sorry, I don't actually work in the CIUs.
No, but DHS...
And look, that's a very good question, and to my knowledge, no.
Okay, so why, if that's their home?
Yep. I couldn't agree more, but unfortunately I can't answer your question.
Oh, that's really my statement. But thank you.
Sorry, I just need to clarify something. Glenn said we also talk about inappropriate sexual behaviours. Then she said, and we're involved in the program Patsy runs. It's not about inappropriate sexual behaviours. But what I wanted to actually raise was that program, which is called Living Safer Sexual Lives. And when Dean introduced me as an expert here this afternoon I felt a bit uncomfortable, because there are a lot of experts in the audience who are people who have participated in Living Safe and Sexual Lives program to become peer educators, to use a program that we have, which was developed from the 25 stories of people with an intellectual disability. And the reason why I just want to raise that, it's not a plug at all. It's actually, it's not. It's because something that there's a need to really think about the whole experience of sexuality and relationships that people have. And it's not a linear thing where you learn to put a condom on and then you have sex, and you learn about a public place and there you have sex. We know that it's much more messy than that. And that's why we developed our program using real-life stories of people with an intellectual disability, because those stories are real, and they talk about things like sex in public places, sex in toilets, having to hide your sexuality from your family. They talk about abuse. They talk about gay and lesbian sex, because that's the real experiences of people. And we've found that using stories and then working with people with intellectual disabilities who then use those stories to speak to other people has been really powerful, because none of it's made up. It's all real, and it happens in a way that it happens for everybody. And then you can start to talk about the things like risk and support and information and access and health and all of those other important things. But it starts from a sense that really knowing that sex and relationships is more often than not messy and all over the place, not linear and starting with rules and sticking with rules. So that's something that I'm actually very passionate about, is developing and further exploring programs with people with disabilities that can work and that are based in reality.
Yeah, can I just add something? Because I don't, as an advocate, I get very frustrated when things, when we're in situations where policies aren't good, but then practices is often quite different. And I think that, when we know that, for many people with disabilities, CIUs are their homes, and yet they're not allowed to make that choice around having a sex worker. I think that is an example of, again, the difference between policy and what we're doing on the ground. I did my research a while back in physical disability, and often it's around practical supports that people might need, around, getting undressed, using a vibrator, support with positioning. Yeah, these are things that the disability sector does not want to even consider or go near. But we need to start having these serious conversations, because if we're going to implement and make things practical, we need practical changes on the ground.
Absolutely. Christian?
The other thing that I really believe in, it's important, it's also that sometimes we need to make a distinction between sex and relationship, because they can always really come together. And also, when it comes to sexuality, I think it's very important really to support people with a disability to discover their body, to discover themselves. And that can be a very empowering experience that can make a hell of a lot of a difference in everyday life, in the way we deal with everything else in our everyday life.
Thank you, Christian. What I'd like to do is actually open up to the audience. So if people have any questions, any comments that they'd like to make, we've got roving mics here. So could we over the back first?
Hi, Martin Stewart here. I'm very, very concerned about the extremely damaging training that support workers receive in most agencies, where when it comes to any access to sex workers, if that's what the need is, the current training in a lot of the services is, well, make sure you give us a call if that happens, because we'll advise them that they need to speak to their relatives, who are, in fact, in a lot of cases, the problem. And it's a disgraceful state of affairs, quite frankly. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody on the panel want to comment on that?
Again, I think that shows that the policy not reflected in practice, and that who wants their mum involved in this? It's not appropriate. We need to ensure that people have a right to independence and privacy. Privacy is important.
I think for a lot of women with disabilities, if they're making an informed decision about wanting to have a sexual relationship, they should be allowed to. I stress the word informed decision because I think something George brought up before about having an unhealthy relationship as opposed to having a power relationship. Some men may use power over women with disabilities. They might, in the man's eye, might look less attractive physically, so that has big implications on the woman. They, some women, rather than having good sexual health, might be put on a contraception, a long-term contraceptive injection, so they won't get pregnant. But it's got nothing to do with a healthy relationship. So I really think a lot more emphasis has to be placed on allowing women to make informed decisions about the relationships they want. One thing we're doing at Women with Disabilities Victoria, we're running some gender and disability workforce training for one of the major disability providers, and that's looking at all the issues, looking through a gender lens of how women and men experience, men with disabilities experience life differently, and how we have to think about what are the differences and how gender plays a really important aspect of our lives, and how what rolls out in our lives is different because of our gender. And that's having the workforce development program is currently a pilot, and the feedback we're getting from staff, disability care staff, has been amazing. That they're rethinking the way they deliver that services. So that's a really good thing, I think.
That's it, yeah.
Just one thing about training. Was it Martin? Yeah. I used to run a lot of training for staff on how to work, looking at sexuality and relationships for people with disabilities. I was involved in the policy that George spoke about. And that was a really, at the time, it was a, quite a progressive policy because it was based on rights, and it it actually was modelled on a policy from the UK that had been very powerful and important in changing the way that sexuality and relationship rights were looked at for people with disabilities in the UK. We spent 5 years developing that policy, going to meetings to get it developed. And it was about to be sent out with me being the person to train the state on all the disability workers on how to implement the policy, and literally the day before I was had a phone call to say, don't go, you can't run this training because the powers that be have got a bit twitchy about it and they want to change it. And the change that they wanted to make was actually about the issue around sex workers and about people's right to use sex workers. And ultimately that was changed and essentially took out of that policy that right about people making a choice about whether they want to see sex workers and how they might be supported to do that. Having said that, far too much of the training that does happen with staff actually focuses on that issue. There's many more issues that we have to think about. And since then, I think I've learned a really important message, which is that one way to change the way staff think is to actually challenge them much more directly about what their thinking is. And we do that through, again, using the Living Safe Sexual Lives program, but it's people with intellectual disabilities running the training, and that has made it a reasonable impact. It hasn't shifted everyone's thinking. So I guess I would say that there's some work to be done by the disability advocacy sector to look at what is within policy at the moment and to get behind, I think, different approaches to changing the way that staff understand their power, I suppose, and then understand their responsibilities.
Thanks, Patsy. We've got a question over here, and then Jared, I think, and then there's a few others over here. So,
my question is, I'm a participant, and if you've got participants that have come to you and said, well, they're bisexual, so they're like both, how would you, as trainers or workers, how would you deal with a client that says they are bisexual instead of just being lesbian or gay, and they like both?
Sorry, I didn't get your name.
Jenny.
Jenny. Hi, Jenny. Look, I would like to think that we have a very open forum in our groups. Now, whether you would want to participate in the group situations or whether you would be requesting one-on-one support, either would be an option. Within the groups, we have an expectation that people will respect one another. We actually have rules. We start off our groups with rules, and the rules include confidentiality. And we find that the people who participate in the groups actually benefit from knowing that they're in a confidential situation. They themselves, the members of the group, have developed the rules, so it's confidentiality, respect, non-judgmental and participation. And if you're a transvestite or you're bisexual or you like having sex upside down or inside out, that's your choice. And everybody within that group must show respect for one another to be part of the group. And that's an expectation of the group members. So you'd be well received.
Just one other thing there. I think there's also work to be done with the disability advocacy sector, working with other rights-based groups, so GLBTI groups in the community. And I know that one part of La Trobe University, which is the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society, have both research and practical work going on to support advocacy in those areas. And I think it's about joining up and making sure that disability is seen as part of those other areas of advocacy as well. Rather than thinking about it as a disability GLBTI issue, let's think about how we can support people with disabilities and the broader groups to understand, include and support the rights of people with disabilities as well.
My name is Jared, and I'm here on behalf of the Youth Disability Advocacy Service. we've talked about what we're happy for people to do in the privacy of their own home or wherever. But if you tell somebody, any two people, that it's okay to have sex in tonight or wherever, sex is very different between whoever you talk to. Sex might not be the same between me or George or, you know, or the next two people. So if you say to somebody with an intellectual disability or a cognitive impairment that, yep, it's cool to have sex tonight with whoever you want, and they end up going to bed and they get something they really didn't really sign up for. Is there in DHS, are you kind of program where you talk about what's expected before the people who are engaging in whatever? I'm not just talking about for the risk sake, but for the enjoyment sake, because people often who have sex, I know the first time I had sex it was shit, and if I wasn't so determined, I probably wouldn't have it again. But for other people, it might be really, really shit, and they might never want to do it ever again. So I'm just asking, is there, does DHS or different CIUs and advocacy services actually talk about, okay, when you go to bed tonight, this is what you're expecting and this is what actually goes down?
Thanks, Jared. Does anybody from the panel want to make a sort of a bit of a comment on Jared's comment and question?
Would you like
George,
me to comment, Jared? Or?
Yeah.
That's a pretty hard one to answer.
It is.
And we've all had good and bad sexual and relationship experiences, I'm sure. Look, once again, I would like to think, and we are a fairly open group. The group we run actually spoke about a similar topic, and so we decided to run a dating program. And we had a whole list of different questions that people wanted answered, and just that, you know, how do you approach somebody? How do I know that you're interested in me? You know, do I go up to you and say, hello, are you interested in me? Just basic questions like that. So we actually wrote up this program, and the guys participated in the men's group and the women in the women's group, and then we shared our answers, and it was quite interesting. So that would be an example of how we might help you to develop those skills. And that's pretty much, once again, it's a peer education program. It's drawing from all the experiences of the members of the group. Patsy, you've got something to add. George.
I'll just add that it's important that you have supports around you or people you can talk to. I think that sex, like anything, you know, it's about practice. So, you know, you might have a bad experience and then you learn from that, and then you have, you know, you might, you know, have one better next time. And, you know, if you're in a position where you have a support network where you can speak to about that, you know, if something happened that, you know, scared you or that you felt maybe you was at risk, then you can go and speak to your doctor, or there's someone that you can talk to. And there are helplines out there, I think, as well, that people can talk to if they have a bad experience.
Thanks, George. Christian?
Yeah, I think Karini, the most important thing really is the experience to have. Because all experience can be very important in our life, It doesn't matter how good or bad those experiences are going to be. We actually help us to grow and to become really who we want to be in our life. Of course, I mean, we need to avoid completely negative experience if possible. But at the end of the day, I do believe that every experience means something, and we can learn from it.
Patsy,
I just want to add one or two things to that. I don't necessarily agree that any experience is a growing and good experience. There are actually bad experiences. There are experiences that are against the law. There's traumatic experiences. And I think that it's really important that we certainly try to avoid those, but we also recognise that they do happen, and that in any education or information that we're involved with supporting or talking with people about, whether it's a formal group or whether it's one-to-one or whether it's as a friend, a relative, a support worker, is that we ensure that people understand that they do have a right to say no, and that if they have experiences that they experience as abusive, that there's something that they can do about that.
Mm-hmm.
We address this in Living Safer Sexual Lives by running groups where we have peer educators and co-facilitators, and the co-facilitators are community professionals who work in services like Centres Against Sexual Health, Sexual Assault, Community Health Services, Women's Health Services, and those peer educators in the room would be able to tell you a lot more about it than me, but the idea about that model is to say, well, I'm certainly not an expert on reproduction, for example. I get very confused about what goes on, but, you know, and I wouldn't be able to explain it as well as a community health nurse can. So what happens in our groups is that, you know, someone will ask a question about sexual health or about reproduction or about contraception, and there's a community health nurse there who can actually work with the peer educator to explain what that information is that person needs. We also need to recognise that each and every one of us have different ways of learning. We learn through friends, we learn through formal stuff, but sometimes we need one-to-one counselling and support. And most often in any person's life, you know, stuff around sexuality and relationships will be one of the things that takes them to a counsellor. And one of the things that I'm trying to, you know, that I've been working on is trying to make sure that counsellors in community health services and other places are equipped to work with people with disabilities. You know, and they people should have that opportunity to go along and have that talk and that support. Yet we won't always avoid the not so good things, and also the kind of not so exciting and wonderful experiences. As long as we can make them as safe and as self-determined as possible, and provide the support around people, I think that's what we need to be looking for.
And before Sharon talks, I just wanted to say that sometimes in forums like this, some of the issues raised can actually cause some distress for people. So it's really important for you to know that if you wanted to talk to anybody about any of the issues that are raised sort of confidentially about where maybe to go for some support from assistance, please come up to the SARU desk and we Sue, myself and some of the panel members could also offer that support if necessary. All right, Sharon.
Just one other point going on from that. What we would do at Women with Disabilities Victoria is try to promote the use of mainstream services rather than disability-specific services. And I just want to, and that's what we're doing at Women with Disabilities Victoria. We're about to develop a healthy services, healthy women package to skill up healthcare service providers to enable them to better include women with disabilities in their everyday services. And I just want to, when I was looking at what we were delivering today, I went back to the state plan. And one of the two items I found really interesting, and it relates to what we're just talking now, the Department of Health is meant to continue providing home and community care, that's HAC, services that respond to sexual diversity among people with disability. Now, as far as I know, HAC services are delivered by local government. That's a mainstream service. So the disability advocacy and other services need to put pressure on DHS and mainstream providers to make sure that's happening. The other point that the Department of Health is also supposed to be delivering is building the awareness of service providers about the sexuality and gender diversity of people with a disability. So again, the Department of Health has a responsibility to make sure those mainstream service providers have much more awareness and can include people with disabilities in their services. And I think we need to move away from disability service-specific providers to mainstream. And that's what the NDIS is about. And surely, if people got packages, they want to be part of the mainstream, not a disability specialist service. So that was just a really important point. I'd like to have my chance now. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon. I'm
going to just add, while we're plugging our services, the Youth Disability Advocacy Service runs a website called youthdisabilityrights.org.au, and on that site we have a section about sexuality where you can learn about your rights in that area. So, check it out.
Fantastic, George. We had some questions still, so... And over here, yes. Over here first, then over this way.
Good Lord, where to start? I'm going to be blunt. I'm 41, pretty sure I'm still straight. So I got that down pat. And there just seems to be an assumption, like, if I wanted just a shag, I could get that. But I want the whole package deal. And it's just assumed that if I want companionship and if I want, you know, a relationship and a partnership and blah, 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 you know, the powers that be that, you know, run the services as such will say, oh, I know someone who's got the same problems. Meet, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, stop helping. You know, how does someone find a relationship, find the package deal when you have a brain injury and you have a disability? Because people just assume I should drop my standards. Why? Why do I have to do that now?
Anybody in the panel? Christian, would you like to comment?
Yeah. One thing that I have not my personal experience in looking for relationship or being in relationship, it actually has a lot to do with the way I feel about myself. So it's all about really confidence. How confident you are in yourself to go out there to show the best of you and to attract other people in your life. I think really this is the most important thing really to have.
Okay, thank you, Christian. Patsy, yeah.
Very unlikely. I kind of don't completely agree with that question. I think that that's part of it, but there's a whole lot of things that go on, as you know, in the life of people with disabilities that are not about disability. They're about society's view about disability. And it's my view that the issue of sexuality in relationships doesn't sit away on its own. It actually is a part of the whole issue of how people with disabilities are seen in the community, how we recognise people with disabilities. I strive to recognise people with disabilities as full people, full human beings with all the good things and the bad things, and that I think that questions about finding relationships is linked up with questions about being accepted and about being valued. And again, I think it's beholden to all of us, and particularly advocacy within an advocacy conference, to think about what we do about those social issues, about the oppression that's happened for people with disabilities over the many, many years, and to certainly use issues like sex and relationships to kind of raise the humanity and the value and the worth of people with disabilities. And to say, okay, this is a social issue. It's not an individual issue about whether you're attractive or whether you're fun or whether you're a good shag. It's actually about a whole lot more than that.
Thanks, Patsy. George, do you have any comments on that from say, an advocacy perspective? Given that I think the Youth Disability Advocacy Service works sort of broadly around a whole range of issues.
It's hard because I agree with what Patsy said, that there's a lot of discrimination out there around having relationships with someone with a disability. I guess what I would say is that, yeah, you're not alone. Like, there's a lot of other people who are in your situation who would absolutely want the whole package, but it's a lot of work. Tinder? You're on Tinder? Try Tinder. Apparently you meet lots of people that way. We need a microphone, sorry.
Thanks.
I was explaining to someone yesterday who was coming today, because she just wanted a shag, her words, and I said, oh, so there's Blender and Tinder. Tinder would probably just get her a shag. Job done. I didn't go with Tinder. I went with Blender, which, if anyone doesn't know, it's the straight version or the bi version of Grindr, if people know what that is. Google it. Look
can
it up.
I explain it?
Can I explain?
Of course you can.
Oh, I have to?
No.
Well, that's what we're talking about. You don't have to.
All right. In brief, Grindr. It's what generally my gay male friends would be on, and it helps them get hooked up for sex or whatever within a short, close radius to where they are at any time. And Blender is sort of the next step if you aren't gay or you don't care which way you go. Is that an appropriate way to put that?
Yeah. And it's an online.
Yeah. Mm. And then Tinder is, you know, like, because I looked at Blender as a dating option and everybody else on there just seemed to look at it as a easy hookup option, which I was like, no. So right. Tinder is just the hardcore, let's shag. And I haven't been on Tinder, so.
I just part of it, though, is about being clear about what you want. And, you know, in these Blender accounts, you can sort of state, you know, that you're after, you know, what you're after. You know, there's no point in putting something out there that's not what you want. So,
yeah.
It's all about marketing in some senses that, you know, you promote your product and see who wants to purchase the.
Okay. Martin, we question over here, and then if we can go over to Christine, and then back to you.
Hi. Me is a real, very relevant topic for us at the moment. That Friday, we received an email from a producer of a panel show on TV wanting to talk about the topic of people with disabilities accessing sex workers. As we talked about today, there's more to people with disabilities sex vendor sex workers. Right. So if you receive that email, how would you respond?
Okay.
Anybody?
I'm not sure if... Okay, so my view is that the emphasis on sex workers is actually somewhat problematic because it assumes that every person with disability should just have to pay for, you know, a transaction. And the reality is that's not what people want. Some people want that. That's fine. But we need to be very, very careful when we promote access to sex workers as an advocacy goal, that we're not saying that that is the answer for the relationship, you know, and the sexual expression needs of people with disabilities. And, God, there have been so many TV shows to do this. I'm so over it. Like, if there's one little show that looks at a sex worker and a person with a disability, I think I'll throw something at the TV.
Thanks, George. We had a question over here from Christine. And then if we could go to the back, and then back here.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean. My name's Christine Williams, and unlike our dear 41-year-old, I'm 64. I believe my sexuality is very linked in with, intertwined with my spirituality. Up until our dear lady over there mentioned she wants it all, which we all have the right to as far as I'm concerned, I was finding the debate quite clinical, quite looking at methodology, looking at policy. I really would like to see sex discussed in a much broader way. I have no problem with a one-night stand if that's what someone's after, be it paid or unpaid or whatever. But I think sex can also be absolutely beautiful within that context of meaningful relationships. So I'd be really interested in what the panel feels. Or is it just a case of I'm getting old?
Patsy?
I think that's a fair reflection. I think often when we talk about sex and relationships and disability, we go to the clinical or the access or the policy. Again, the way that we've addressed that in the work that we do is, as I said, to use whole stories, whole real-life stories, which are about, the people and the people and the relationship and sexuality within their lives. However, having said that, for the work that I do as a researcher with people with an intellectual disability, often the issues or that we're addressing is the lack of opportunity people have had to have sex, but also to have relationships. So very often we just pointed straight there because that's the issue, that's the hot topic, and around that comes all those other questions about acceptance and self-determination and love and relationships and community and all those things. So I agree with you, but I think it's really a bit about the time and resources, unfortunately, that you have to deal with stuff too. And people want to say, okay, that's all very well, but how can I start to talk about sex in my life? And that's often where we have to start.
Could I perhaps just suggest that for a future conference we might be able to hear some stories? I mean, I'm sure Christian is a very sensual man. He knows that because I've told him often enough. And I would imagine George isn't a virgin. So I'd be quite interested in hearing their stories of what has been, you know, a deep and meaningful sexual encounter relationship for them. So perhaps you can, or the conference organisers might think of something like that for the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Christian had a comment. So would you like to talk about some of your conquests?
I would control myself. I mean. really, what I would like to say, I think the more people with a disability are involved in community life, the more opportunity for sex and relationship will come. This is really how I see it. I mean, the lack of opportunity, a lack of the kind happen because we don't have enough opportunity to be involved within the the community for whichever reason. I think when we go have the opportunity to live a full life, that will create also opportunity for check and relationship. And one thing that I personally have noticed in, especially when dealing with people who don't have a disability, at the beginning they are very uncomfortable. When you talk to them about sex or about relationship, but as they start to know you, to go beyond the physical appearance that, for example, I have, well, they discover a completely different world, really.
Okay, thanks, Christian. We had another question over here, and then back to Andrew.
I'm not from the mainland, I'm from Tasmania, and I'm just interested in what kind of support is on this side of the water for people who want to go the next step further and have a mild intellectual disability and are in a relationship and don't want to have a family. I'm myself married to a gentleman on the spectrum and we have a 17-month-old daughter, but I know many years ago a passing comment from a not-so-lovely person said, oh, you probably wouldn't be able to handle having a family. And then my mother-in-law at the time said, oh, yeah, you probably would, but you'd probably only be able to manage one child. And, I mean, we want to have a family, have at least two children. I mean, why should we be restricted to only one child? And I know from experience of being in hospital, having our daughter, we got a lot more support and they may have thought we were a bit stupid and naive and they wanted to make sure before we went home that we were able to care for this child, which was all well and good. But in some ways, they were very condescending and wrapped us up in cotton wool. And then on the morning before we were due to be released, it was sort of like, oh, well, you can do it all today. We're not going to support you anymore. And I also have other people that I've met that are looking at having a family through other resources because, once again, when they were younger, it was sort of put into their mind that sex is a bad thing. Do not go there. So they need other ways to start a family. And when dealing with medical people, it was sort of suggested to them, oh, so will you have the support when you take the baby home? And expected that they wouldn't, you know, this child is going to be at high risk. Or, and personally, me and my husband, we've experienced that also with trying to gain support in our local area that you know, they thought we were a bit silly and that we didn't know what we're doing and that our child was labelled high risk. And I know there's other people that have had their children taken off them from the word go. But I often think, will we face that when our child reaches school age? Or, you know, will we cope? And there needs to be a lot more support out there for those of us who can and want to have a family.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. George, do you want to...
Thank you for sharing that story. I'd like to just draw attention to Jeanette Lee, who's in the room at the back. Hi, Jeanette. Jeanette's an advocate at Urella, and she's done a lot of work in supporting parents with disabilities. And yeah, this conference is about advocacy. I know that a lot of good work's gone into supporting parents with disabilities to use their ISPs for, is that right, Jeanette? For, well, before the policy was that you couldn't use your ISP on anyone but yourself. Now that policy's been changed, so, part of your role as a parent, and to fulfil that role, you might need support. So, yes, there's been some good advocacy. But we have to keep doing it, right? So you might want to catch up with Janet in the break.
Does anybody else on the panel have any comments? Glyn, yeah.
Are you actually registered with the Department of Human Services?
She's in Tassie.
In Tassie? So... Right.
We're sort of in the forgotten bunch. Where we've never had much like caseworkers or support or anything like that. We sort of flew under the radar, and then as soon as the baby comes into the picture, and it's very sad that you have to have a child to get noticed, you know. And I know there's others out there, like, for instance, I have a family member who's just become a parent for the first time, and she would have, both of her and her husband have intellectual disabilities, very mild, but they're there. And I don't know what support she will get, but then you're faced with parents that are a bit overbearing and think that you're stupid and that you don't know how to look after a child, so they do everything for you. A lot like other people with disabilities, that, you know, family members might think, well, you don't want to have a life, so we'll just keep you at home and you'll live for us forever. And when we move on to the next life, what will happen then? You know, they've got no skills to get out there and be independent and live to full potential.
Okay. There is an organisation called Parenting Research. I can't give you the details. I don't know if there's anyone here who would have contact details. It is Victorian, but I'm sure they wouldn't... Healthy Start Parenting Research. They have lots of excellent resources, and we use their resources. They're available to general members of the community, so that may be an option for you. And from Tasmania, it's online. You can go online.
I'm looking at connecting with the powerful parenting team.
Oh, okay,
that's
great.
From here and. Maybe good. Starting up a Facebook page and connecting in that way. So it's something that we will be exploring further.
That's fantastic.
Excellent.
Can I also suggest maybe having a chat to Jeanette in the break, so after this, because Jeanette's sort of involved in an advocacy group, so that might be something that might be of some help as well. Yeah. Okay, so if we could go then to Andrew, and then we'll come over to Anna.
Hi, my name's Andrew. I had a few bad experiences, but because of it was Mo and the people who was involved, were men, and I did not enjoy it. But I said I tried to get counselling, but there was none when I was 6 years old, and I fell in the hole. and I took time out and had, and when I moved to Victoria, I didn't know there were any programs about sex or anything other than when I joined the SRMC, I learned about those programs and I decided to join that program and they helped me a lot since I went to Victoria.
Thank you, Andrew. Anna, you had a question?
My name is Anna Bogle and I come all the way from Cobram. About 5 years ago, there was a segment on TV about young girls who, when they felt pregnant, they didn't have the option as to what they should do. So one girl, she was only about maybe 16 at the time, and the boy she was going with decided he didn't want to take the responsibility of having a family. So what she had to do in the end was give the baby up. And this in itself resulted in a very, you know, sort of sad way. She never ever saw the baby again. And I don't know what's right in this situation. If you don't have any help or any, or you do find yourself in a situation that you're pregnant, who do you turn to? That's the question is asked by everybody. And when I saw that segment on TV, I couldn't really believe it. That what was she supposed to do? No job, too young, a man who didn't really want her. So where was she to go?
Okay. Do we have some comments about that from the
I've only got one comment. Yeah. It's kind of general, but, you know, there is a saying that it takes a village to raise a child. And I think that you've got to find that village, I suppose. And I think that for many people with an intellectual disability, and Naomi, I thank you for sharing your story, it actually just highlights again what I was speaking about earlier, is that people with an intellectual disability are somehow seen as different when it comes to questions of relationships and of parenting. I think we have to move towards the centre a bit further, you know, further towards the centre, that says they're just like any other parents who'll need help, who'll need support, who'll need resources. And it's what Sharon raised earlier. That's about working with mainstream services so that they understand how you give that support without making people feel overprotected or cut loose. So I think there's that work to do with the mainstream services and, as I said, to kind of acknowledge that if it does take a village, to find the village and not expect people to do it on their own.
Thanks, Patsy. Look, we probably have time for one more question. It's hitting on 3 o'clock. Over here.
Again, I need to warn back what you said a long while before because services should be, you know, it's sort of, they should be told to do help the clients, because if they don't help the clients and you jump up and down, they cause you your troublemaker. Now, these services need the training. But they gotta be told to take the training, and not just staff, all the managers too, because the manager, a lot of the managers that work in the disability fields know nothing about disability. They only know enough to help to run a business. So Dean, I support what you said, but we gotta make sure the managers get the training session. We gotta demand that they do the training, because if they don't do the training, they might be a great business person, but still come back to, they don't know how to take, they don't know how to take care, respond to people with a disability.
Okay, thank you for that. We can take one more question or comment. So Jan, just down here. And then I think we'll have to break.
Christian, the most sensual thing about you are those purple suede shoes, but I don't think that makes me a shoe fetishist, Steph, necessarily. Gore Vidal, a famous American writer, said that sex is highly overrated. He lived with a man for 50 years and reckoned he didn't shag him, but I reckon he was a lying old bugger. Indeed, he was a bugger.
Thank you. Take that as a comment. Amanda, I think we can fit you in. One last one. How about that? And then we'll thank the panel and thank the audience.
I'm not normally lost for words, but this is like something I've never... I'm not normal. I'm just having a hard time dealing with this, and it's opened my eyes, and I've got a lot of mixed feeling in this area, and I've been alone. And I can't describe what I'm going through. I need to talk to somebody. Thank you.
Thanks, Amanda. So I'm sorry that this has caused a bit of distress for you, so sorry about that. So I'd just really like to thank everybody for their participation today. Thank you to you for some wonderful comments and some insightful questions, and I'd also like to thank the panel for their insights and their answers to questions, and I'm sure there's a lot more discussion to happen around sexuality, around relationships, around dignity of risk, around training, around a broad area. So once again, thank you for coming along.